I am so glad that you are not in Chicago there, because my friends in Chicago all have this massive snowstorm, and you do not.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I've got, like, green trees and grass in the background. It's a little embarrassing, but
no,
it's Texas.
It's so. Fantastic. You are in Austin, Texas, right?
I am, yes.
The bastion of progressivism in Texas, yeah?
We do consider ourselves the blueberry in the red state,
okay,
or something like that. So, yeah, there's a lot of progressives in Austin, and there's a lot of non-progressives in Austin, too. So.
Oh, wow. It's so diverse. It's like the kingdom of God. Yeah. Everyone is welcome, right?
Right.
Everyone's
right,
welcome
yeah.
in Austin. I like it. That's fantastic. You are teaching homiletics at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary.
Yes.
How long have you been doing that there at Austin?
Since 2015.
2015.
So this is my third year.
Okay, how's it going so far?
It's going great. Good. I love being in Austin. I'm originally from San Antonio, so it's good to be closer to family again. I'm part of a big family. There's six kids, and my parents still live in San Antonio, so it's been great to be back.
That's awesome. My son spent his first 8 years in Chicago. Now we live out in Portland, Oregon, and for some reason, he is a gigantic Spurs fan.
Oh, good. Well deserved.
Yes.
The Spurs should have a lot of loyal fans.
Yes.
They've been a great team for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And Greg Popovich is just amazing. So, yeah, that's fun. You so you grew up in San Antonio and you ended up in Whitworth.
Yes.
Whitworth,
that's
University,
right.
Up in Spokane. How did you end up in Whitworth?
Well, so I grew up going to a Presbyterian church, and when I was about 15, I felt called to ministry, and it just so happened that the youth director at my church had a promotional video about Whitworth and its message of, you know, a mind and heart education, and the messages I heard from the religion professors there sounded like it was going to be a very immersive kind of formative experience, and that's what I found it to be. So I went all the way from San Antonio to Spokane for college. Was not expecting the cold and dark, but I made it. It was fine.
Nicely done.
Lovely.
It's a bit of a culture shock, I would imagine, from San Antonio, especially a weather shock.
Yes, yes. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you went to Princeton Theological Seminary.
Mm-hmm.
So from the West Coast, from the South to the West to the East. So you've kind of been all over the map.
Yes. Yeah. Right after seminary, where I met my husband, we decided to do year-long CPE programs, clinical pastoral education. And for that, we moved down to Yuma, Arizona, on the U.S.-Mexico border, right next to California. So, yeah, we've kind of been all over.
Yeah, I imagine it was quite an experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really rich. It was really rich.
Yeah, yeah. And then you got your PhD from Emory University.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And you were teaching assistant for Tom Long, Teresa Fry Brown, and Luke Timothy Johnson. And
yes.
I just had to name drop because I have this holy envy as I read that. It's just like, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
I know, and they're just regular people,
yeah.
But they really are amazing. They're you can touch them, but they really are the amazing people you think they are. So
awesome. You can touch them, and you won't burn. That's fantastic.
No, won't burn, right.
Well, I wanted to invite you on because I got this fantastic book called Anxious to Talk About It, Helping White Christians Talk Faithfully About Racism. And I'm sorry that it's backwards there. It just happens every time. But that's the way it goes. And it's by Carolyn Helsel. How about that?
That's me.
It's you. And it's fantastic.
Me.
And it's, as I was reading it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is just fantastic for me personally. And it would be great for, you know, churches to talk about as they read it. And that's the audience that you had in mind for this book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Predominantly white churches who aren't currently talking about it. There's a lot of great resources for churches to go deeper who are already having these conversations. But this is really aimed to help churches who don't know where to start or are having a hard time getting this conversation off the ground, kind of a way to kind of let them in on this conversation.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and we have a live audience, and I just want to make sure that everyone in the live audience knows that you can make comments and ask questions over on the Raven Foundation Facebook page. Just leave a comment and a question there, and I'll try to get them in. Carolyn, how did you get, why this book? Why racism? What is it about this topic that has basically led you to devote your life to it?
Yeah. That's a great question. As I mentioned briefly, you know, I felt called to ministry at an early age. So I have been kind of steeply immersed in the Christian tradition for most of my life. And for me to go to seminary, you know, in my early 20s, and to finally learn that racism was still a problem that white Christians weren't talking about was really alarming and shocking, because when you devote that much time and energy to kind of studying what does it mean to be faithful, what does it mean to be a Christian, what is our Christian tradition, and to not learn about all of the ways that racism has played a part in Christian history, as well as continues to be part of our current present day situation, was just really disturbing to me. So I'm trying to kind of return back to these same communities that have been so faithful in raising me in the faith, but to say we need to be talking about this as well as part of our discipleship.
Yeah. Do you, so you go around to churches and do a lot of speaking engagements at churches. What do you get? What are the reactions that you get from white Christians on this topic?
Sometimes I get no reaction, which means they're polite and they don't like the way I'm talking about it and they're not going to tell me. So that's just a silent kind of, you know, I'm not interested, I don't need to be talking about this kind of reaction. But then I've had other people who are just nodding their heads, who are like, yes, thank you. I've had such a hard time trying to say things that I feel need to be said because I'm worried I'm saying the wrong thing. And so I get kind of a wide range of responses, but it's kind of hoping to plant a seed where I can and to hopefully encourage people to take these conversations further.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I want to do another name dropping for you here right at the beginning, because this guy named Walter Brueggemann has this quote.
Yeah.
This book is spot on for the kinds of conversations we need to be having. And that's exactly how I felt about it too. So congratulations on the book. And my next question is that oftentimes when I try to bring up these conversations, there's a kind of resistance that says things like, well, if we just stop talking about racism, it'll just go away. So the more that you talk about racism, the more you foment it. How do you respond to that?
Yeah. Well, kind of taking a historical look, you know, I was born, you know, early 80s. And right before that, there was a lot of talk about racism. For a couple of decades, people were talking about race. And at the same time, there was still a lot of division. You know, there weren't a lot of easy answers. And a lot of white people felt like, well, if we just stop talking about this, maybe it'll go away. And there was a lot of resentment, I think, in a lot of white communities of feeling like the bar is constantly moving of what's politically correct. And so there was all kind of misunderstanding of what the goal was. You know, the goal isn't making people be politically correct. You know, the goal is helping us be more hospitable and more open to hearing about these stories that continue to cause people pain. So I think for people who say, if we just don't talk about it, it might go away, I want to say, I can see how that's been an approach that has been taken in the past. You know, that's something that we've tried and it's not working. So it is something that we just need to keep trying to figure out. Talking about it for a while may not work either. You know, we have to constantly reevaluate our methods and modes so that we can see what works, because ultimately we're not in it to be correct in our speech or to say it a certain way, but we're ultimately aiming at deeper connections, deeper relationships, a greater sense of community, so that we do at one point get beyond race, but that's, you know, centuries from now. Yeah. I mean, it's not something that's in our lifetime.
There is a sense in which political correctness, like, I love the idea of political correctness. To me, it's just like, hey, let's stop being jerks. But there is a sense in which it can go overboard where, and I see this in this conversation, where you can, in the name of trying to get people to stop being jerks, you end up acting kind of like a jerk. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just like the way that we have, it's one of the things that I love about your book is you can tell that CPE had a really good impact on you in trying to empathize with people who are struggling with this topic. Does that make sense? Like there's a non-judgmental presence as you wade through these conversations that I really appreciate in your book.
Well, I appreciate you crediting it to my year of CPE. CPE is hard, but I'm glad I went through it. But I think rather than it being, you know, something that I learned, you know, 14, 15 years ago, I think it's something I've learned on the journey just in order to care for myself, really, to give myself grace in the midst of doing things wrong and not being this good white person that I imagine that I need to be in order to do this right. And so once I've started to kind of accept my own limitations and my own inadequacies, that's in turn given me greater permission to kind of give others that same grace. So ultimately it's selfish. You know, I'm just trying to make myself feel good by, not looking past my inadequacies, but accepting that if I just dwell on those inadequacies, I'm not going to keep going. I'm not going to sustain myself in this long journey. And each of us needs to sustain ourselves for this journey because it's a long journey. It's not something that we get done with and, you know, do a workshop and then, okay, we're good white people and, you know, we don't need to talk about it anymore. But it's a long journey.
Yeah, and it's one of the emphases in your book is self-care. And we good Christians, people who think of ourselves as good Christians, try to love our neighbor and forget to love ourselves in the process. And that comes through in your book also. So that's awesome. But one of the things about racism that's tough for white people, that's tough for me as a white person, is that I'm often blind to it because I don't live it every day. And so it's hard for me to see. It's like having Saul's turns into Paul when the scales fall from his eyes and his eyes are open to the ways that he's participated in scapegoating. And that's painful when that happens.
Yeah.
Right. One of the things that you talk about in your book is kind of continued segregation, which for me, I'm like, well, hey, segregation like that left long ago. So how do you still see segregation happening in the United States?
Mm-hmm. So we've moved a lot, as you know from my biography. You know, my husband and I have had like 10 different places, you know, that we've called home. And when you move a lot and you've got children, you're looking for places where you can live where your children will get the best education. That's kind of one of your priorities in your mind is, you know, how do I resettle my kids so that they can get the benefits that I want for them? And so you're looking in neighborhoods that have the best schools. In the major cities across this country, wherever you look, the schools with the best, highest ratings are the schools that are also predominantly white. The schools that are in the most expensive neighborhoods. And a lot of that has to do with a segregation that isn't over, you know, that started in the early part of the 20th century when our Federal Housing Administration started giving the GI Bill and giving people after World War II who are coming back to start families, mortgages. But those mortgages were only given primarily to white homeowners. And the underwriting that took place for those homes had something called redlining in it. So if a black veteran came back and wanted to buy a home, but in a predominantly black neighborhood, they would say that investment is too risky. It's within this redlined area. And so we're not going to underwrite the mortgage, even if they were given a mortgage. So it's just this long history of segregation that, again, wealth happens, over time. And so the amount of wealth that's built up to kind of create the segregation, again, doesn't go away in a generation, in a decade. So we still see that segregation across the major cities where schooling is better in some neighborhoods than in others. So that's one of the ways that I see it. But also in churches, we still talk about churches being, 11 o'clock hours, MLK notice, being the most segregated hour. So we see it in our churches too. So even if the workplace is becoming more diverse, our places of higher education, colleges and universities are becoming more diverse. Our churches and the places where our kids grow up is often still primarily segregated.
You also have a great section on Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, in the prison industrial complex, which is segregated.
Yeah. And we don't hear those stories, very often. It's important for us to learn about that.
Yeah, it's sad because it's such a great book, Michelle Alexander's book, but it's kind of in the past now. Yeah, you're right. Like, we don't talk about it very much anymore, but that's still, that's a huge issue of racism in America. So, sadly.
The long-term effects that imprisonment has on communities, on families, on individuals. If you were imprisoned, it makes it really hard for you to get jobs, for you to support your family. And the reason why you were imprisoned may be because you were targeted because of your skin color, or, because you were doing drugs when, people in white communities are doing drugs too, but aren't as heavily policed as poor neighborhoods. So it's that unequal kind of sentencing and the problems that leads to.
There was, the Eagles just won the Super Bowl. And there were all of these stories of white people in Philadelphia having parties in the streets and pushing over cars and stuff. And so many memes of, like, if white people are doing it, it's a party. And if black people are doing it, it's a riot. And you need to bring in the cops and everyone to come in and arrest them. And it's just another, like, pretty, I'm like, yeah, that happens. It's pretty blatant racism happening there. That I, as a white person, would just be like, yeah, it's just kids partying. So let them party. It's a mess. So one of the things that you talk about that I'm seeing more and more on Facebook and Facebook conversations about this is white fear of black anger, and white fear that black people are out to turn the tables on us. And so we shouldn't work for this because it's just going to be a flip of the power situation. And you talk about white fear this really well in your book, and I'm wondering if you can address it.
Sure. Looking at history, we know how deadly white fear can be. It was white fear of having black men, rape white women that led to lynch mob after lynch mob of taking innocent men out of their home and killing them. The fear that white people have is something that can really have deadly and devastating consequences. And so sometimes that fear that and the capacity for violence that white people have, they project it onto others. And so they know they have that capacity. And so they project that capacity onto others and say, well, this might happen to me, so I better strike first. And That's not the way that we live in a democracy. That's not the way that we try to live in a peaceable kingdom. So, yeah, helping us to kind of understand that fear and try to help us work towards a place where we're not acting out of fear, and where we're showing kind of the unequal distribution of weapons, unequal distribution of ways that people can really do serious damage to others. There was like this jokey NRA commercial. It wasn't really the NRA on Facebook that I saw recently, where these white men had these guns and we're talking about, we have the right to defend our communities. And then, this black guy comes on and he's like, "Yeah, we have the right to defend our communities." The two guys are like, right. But clearly they're uncomfortable with it, right? So yeah, just this kind of yeah, two ways of approaching it that are definitely not equal.
That it reminds me, sometimes I have a Facebook friend who says, "I'm not angry, I just want to survive." You know, it's about survival. And you tell so many, one of the things that I love about your book is that you talk about there is a need for providing reasonable arguments. But what really gets us is stories. What really transforms us are stories. And I'm wondering if you can tell a story from your chapter, The Truth and Reconciliation Oral History Project.
Yeah, well, this has been a gift that I've been able to be part of. One of our alumni from the seminary, an African American guy who, grew up in Texas in a small town and is continuing to kind of work with his community, working with the white pastors in his small town to talk about race, came up with this idea that we need to tell more stories. We need to hear more stories, but also give distance between the people who are sharing the stories and the white communities who need to hear them, because sometimes these stories are, very painful to share. And it's hard when you don't know if the white community who hears that story will honor that gift and, won't try to reinterpret it or to somehow challenge the experience of the storyteller. So he has gone and, collected these stories through this oral history project. We had our first one last spring. We'll have another one this spring in Austin. And the goal is to invite people to share their experiences with racism. And some of these stories have been just really eye-opening and powerful. But not only the stories of the people who are being interviewed, but also the stories of the people who have come to help interview. So some of the interviewers are students from historically black colleges and universities from across Texas. There are nine HBCUs in Texas, and I think seven of them are part of this consortium. And getting to meet many of the interviewers as they came last year. One of them I got to sit next to for lunch. And I sit down and then go, get some silverware and come back, and I learned that this guy, has spent time in prison, and so, this, my initial reaction is like, uh-oh, I left my purse here, it was that bad idea, which is silly, like no one's gonna take my purse, in the middle of a crowded cafeteria, but just overcoming my initial fear of what it means to, have gone to prison and to say, like, what a gift of learning about this man's story and hearing all that he's had to overcome and the kinds of sacrifices that he's made. And it just really moved me to feel like, wow, yeah, there's a lot going on that I know very little about, but I want to learn more about.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about in your book that helps me learn more about is that here at Raven, we talk about mimetic theory, which kind of helps us understand the different ways that we are formed by what we call the other, right? So this can be individuals, and this can be culture at large. And I see this in the way that we are formed kind of into racism in ways that, again, blind us. And you talk a couple of different ways about how our culture forms us into this in kind of an unconscious way. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and it's just part of the air we breathe. Right, yeah. You know, I teach girls who are part of my daughter's age group. She's 7 in Girl Scouts, and I've been one of their Girl Scout leaders for the past few years. But when they started in kindergarten, you know, even then, you know, I'm hearing things like, "I don't like the color brown," you know, from one of the little girls of color in the group. And I'm struck by how early even things like color preference, you know, make such a big impression. We don't like the color brown. There was an artist who was doing a workshop at the local art museum on color theory and, you know, talking about how these different colors make us feel, and asked us what our favorite colors were. And she was reflecting on, across society, do you know what the least favorite colors are?
Black and brown.
Gray and brown.
Gray and brown. Okay.
Gray and brown. And we associate gray with aging. And so, you know, women do pay all sorts of money to dye their hair so you can't see our gray, and brown, and how that plays into colorism and our preference. But, you know, there's really, you know, what would we do without brown bark or chocolate or good soil or cinnamon? I mean, all of these wonderful things that are brown that that we've been just kind of, you know, it's just part of the air that we breathe to have these preferences that really make an impact on people's self-esteem as well.
Yeah. And you talk about cartoons. And when we're roughly the same age, I think, and when we were growing up, a lot of cartoons, the villain appeared as brown, darker skin.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And these are just kind of ways that we are formed into without realizing it. And, you know, the people who are making these cartoons probably aren't doing this consciously either. It's, as you say, it's just part of the air that we breathe. And so it's just, this is just what happens. So, you talked about color theory, which I've never heard before, but that's fascinating. But you also talk in the book about race identity theory.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit
about racial identity?
This is the first time that I came across it.
Yeah, so it started back in, you know, the 60s and 70s when white therapists were trying to understand the anger of some of their black clients. And, you know, for a while thinking, well, this wasn't healthy, but then realizing, no, actually, this is a very healthy response to the oppression that they're experiencing. And so helping people understand kind of this progression towards a greater healthy self-esteem when you're living in a society that, you know, gives you all sorts of hateful messages. So, you know, fast forward, people started thinking about white identity development. Like, okay, well, if people of color need some sort of progress towards a healthy sense of self, you know, what would that look like for white people whose sense of whiteness is already unhealthy, is already distorted through these ideas of superiority and supremacy? And so they started kind of tracking kind of what a healthy identity development would look like for white people. And I found this to be really, really helpful because it identified some of those feelings and emotions that come with learning about racism, the shame, the guilt, these kind of disorienting feelings like, oh, gosh, I'm not the good person that I've been trying so hard to be. And then moved forward to show that there's like all these other stages beyond that. You know, that it's not the end goal to stay in shame or guilt. That's not the purpose. That's not a healthy view of oneself. You can't constantly live in that sense of guilt. So how do we move forward? And, you know, they kind of lay out these different stages of ways that white people can move through it. And for me, that felt good. I mean, you commented about, you know, my empathy. I think pastoral care has really been a significant part of my formation of trying to help people care for themselves as well as care for others. And so I felt like this was kind of a natural part understanding how do I care for the white people that I know and love who are trying to grow and who are trying to learn about this and who need some help, as well as for my own kind of sense of development. How do I grow into this? How do I keep learning? So it was helpful on a number of levels for me.
Do you think that we have something of an idolatry of goodness happening in American Christianity, especially progressive American Christianity? There's such an emphasis on being good, and I think that's part of the problem, because the worst thing you can be in progressive Christian circles is a racist. And I think when we deny that, it's just part of the air that we breathe, and so it infects me. Like that's part of the way that I've been able to deal with this, is kind of reclaiming a sense of sin.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we haven't talked about sin for a long time as progressives, because at least from my experience growing up and becoming more immersed in an evangelical culture when I went away to college, you know, a lot of sin was heavily associated with sex, with, you know, sexual immorality, you know, and so sin became this a certain kind of morality that also kind of was very cultural specific and didn't seem to take into consideration the ways that our society, you know, more broadly is sinning through these different forms of oppression. How even the way we talk about some forms of sexual sin is sinning about, you know, our idolatry of women's purity, you know, in viewing women as having to be pure in order to be the wives of good standing men. So helping to unpack some of that, but as progressives, because we've moved away from sin, we have a hard time talking about the real impact of sin in our lives, in our society. We've lost that sense of personal sin that I think has been really helpful in understanding this Christian walk is not something that we do overnight. That's not something that, you know, we are forgiven for our sins and that's it. We never sin again. You know, that's not the way that that our faith works. We know that we're constantly, you know, sinning and continuing to mess up and in constant need of grace. So how can we open ourselves up in a way that helps us hear continually ways that we are messing up and be open with that sense of humility to know we haven't arrived, progressive or not, you know, we have a lot to learn.
And yeah. And without acknowledging the sin component, you can't get to anything that looks like repentance. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you talk about the interplay between class and race, which is a really important part of this conversation too.
Yeah, I talk about how there's a number of different ways that our identity impacts how we view race. And class is definitely one of those. You know, if you grew up having absolutely, you know, no advantages in your mind, no privileges, and yet you're a white person being told that you have white privilege, you know, it can be really frustrating, you know, and just knowing that there's a number of ways that people are disadvantaged in our society. People do have a lot of things that they've overcome. And so focusing less on kind of concepts of privilege and more on how do we understand how our identity has been formed and how do we work with other people to make this world a better place? So again, it's not a requirement that you use a certain set of language or to confess your white privilege, but it is important that you see how we need each other and try to work across our differences. So class is definitely one of those ways that people can kind of feel ostracized from this conversation. Like, you don't know what I grew up with. You don't know the communities that I'm still part of. They don't experience white privilege. So if that's the kind of requirement to enter into this conversation, you know, I can't be there. You know, I'm not going to be able to join you.
Yeah. You talk about having a state of gratitude in this. Talk about gratitude and why that's important, because a lot of it, as we've been talking about, is based on shame. Even the phrase white privilege, as you were talking about it, kind of gave me a sense of it's shaming white people into this.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work. Talk about more of a position of gratitude in this.
Yeah, yeah. As I think about, my call to ministry, it's always kind of been intertwined with this sense of preaching. And yet preaching out in a public sense is all often, conveyed negatively. Oh, she's just preaching at us. Or, you sound very preachy. It's got this negative connotation. But ultimately, the best kind of preaching is something that calls you to action, that inspires you, that makes you want to live a different way, that reminds you of who you are and the grace that God has given you and empowers you to go out and make a difference. So in conversations about something like racism, how do we do the work of anti-racism in a way that is that kind of positive sense of preaching, of empowering people to go out and make a difference? Yes, it's important for us to know that we are messing up and continue to mess up, but how do we have the strength and the grace to move on? And a lot of that comes from gratitude, of knowing God is continuing to redeem us and continuing to work in us, and having that sense of gratitude for God's work is what can sustain us, as well as gratitude for the people that we know and love, who we know are impacted by this, who we know have had a different experience of life than we have. And our gratitude and love for them is also what makes us think, yes, I want to do what I can. I know I'm not going to be perfect, but I love these folks. I love this person in my life, and I want to try to make the world more hospitable for him or her.
That's awesome. As we close, you talk about preaching. You teach preaching. Do you have any quick advice for preachers who might want to preach on this topic?
Sure. I think this understanding of recognition in three forms, the challenge of recognizing racism as an idea that it's harder than we think for people who are white to understand what it is we're talking about. So use stories, use ways of helping people see this in a way that they can. The second part is recognizing ourselves as white is a challenge. So helping people through that in a way that can help them accept that discomfort and move through it. But then third, recognition is gratitude. I want to recognize those who have helped me to get here. That sense of recognition as gratitude as being the motivator. How can your sermon root this message in a sense of gratitude? And that's going to be the focus of my next book, which will be coming out in the fall, which will be, Anxious to Preach About It, which will be kind of following on the heels of this book.
I love it. I love it. Well, Carolyn, thanks again so much for being here and talking with me about your book, Anxious to Talk About It. I look forward to reading Anxious to Preach About It. So it's going to be awesome in the fall. And maybe we can have another conversation about that. This has been a lot of fun for me. So thank you for being here.
That would be
great.
Thanks so much. Thanks
you bet. Yeah. If people want to keep up with you and your work, how can they do that?
I have a website, carolynhelsel.com, that has opportunities where I'm speaking this spring, and I'll try to keep it updated. As I also have a blog that I'm not very frequent at posting on, but I'm trying to be better. So those two places, for sure.
That's okay. You're busy. You're preaching. You have kids. You have a family. It's good. It's a busy life.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely. Well, God bless you and your work. And thank you again for being here.
Great. Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for watching. We've got a few comments. Aaron O'Neill says, thank you, Carolyn. Guillermo says, thanks. Lindsay's talking about Snowmageddon up in Chicago, so that's fun. So we should just all move to Austin. Austin
yeah,
sounds
you
like
should.
The
That's
kingdom
pretty
of
great.
God. Great weather, conservatives, liberals getting along. It's fantastic. So
yeah, move to Austin.
Yes,
pretty great.
Move to Austin. So thank you everybody for watching. You can watch this on the Raven Foundation Facebook page or on the Raven Foundation website and on Teaching Nonviolent Atonement website. We will have another live conversation next week on the Raven Foundation Facebook page. Until then, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.